You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
As Will said, my name is John Charbach. My wife and I have been members here for about 5 years. We've been coming here for about 6 years. We did a gospel community. And as he was saying, we were kind of doing sermon planning a few weeks back, and I was making the argument that, like, we need to treat Genesis 39 through 41 as a single coherent narrative. Because it's not really a story about Joseph's integrity. It's not really a story about Joseph's suffering. It's a story about God and how God weaves together Joseph's integrity, Joseph's suffering, and everyone else's disobedience to bring about his purposes, which are the salvation of his people. And so there's one sense in which I won that argument, because we're going to treat Genesis 39 through 41 together today. And there's another more important sense in which I lost that argument, because I'm the one who gets to do it. So my goal is to get you out of here sometime before sundown. If you would open your Bibles and follow along, that'll really help, because we're going to work through this text section by section. If you don't have a Bible, grab a pew Bible in front of you. The text is on page 33 of the Old Testament. So this narrative picks up more or less where chapter 37 left off. Joseph has been sold into slavery by his brothers, and he ends up down in Egypt. And he's bought by a man named Potiphar, who's the captain of the guard of Pharaoh. And that probably means that he's kind of Pharaoh's bodyguard. He's responsible for protecting Pharaoh. And he's also responsible for executing high-ranking prisoners, which will actually end up being significant a little later on. And then this text will unfold in three scenes. Joseph in slavery, Joseph in prison, and then finally Joseph before Pharaoh. And the pattern is going to be that Joseph is going to do the right thing, and then a misfortune is going to occur to him. And then he's going to do the next right thing, and then another misfortune is going to occur to him. And that pattern is going to continue throughout the text until very suddenly God is going to exalt Joseph to a position of great power. And what will become clear at the end of it is that God has been weaving together Joseph's obedience and Joseph's affliction to bring about his purposes. So, if I were to boil down this text to a single main point, it would be that God is in complete control. And so as a result, we can do the next right thing and trust him with the results. God is in complete control. We can do the next right thing and trust him with the results. So we're going to work through the three scenes together today. And the three scenes are kind of scene one, God is in control in bad times. Scene two, God is in control in worse times. And then scene three, God is in control in the best times. All right, so things start out okay for Joseph. He arrives in Egypt, and look at verse two. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man. And he was in the house of his Egyptian master. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him. And he made him overseer over his house and put him in charge of all that he had. And from the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had, in house and in field. And so he left all that he had in Joseph's charge. Here's the pattern that we're going to see a couple of times, that Joseph gets put in a very bad situation, and then Joseph, in spite of that, does good to his captors. And through his hard work, God ends up blessing his captors. His captors recognize what's going on and therefore give Joseph more responsibility. And then eventually Joseph's running the whole show. And so I'll kind of describe this as Joseph is just trusting God and doing the next right thing. And we see the start of what looks like an upward trending graph. It's, from your perspective, upward trending graph. It's going up and to the right. Things seem to be improving in Joseph's life. And you might expect that the story would kind of continue. Joseph climbs the career ladder in Egypt, gets recognized by Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, this man is far too valuable to be a slave to the captain of the guard. Let's bring him in and have him administer my government or whatever. But that's actually not what happens. Take a look at verse 6 of chapter 39. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, and after a time, his master cast his eyes on Joseph and said, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph, important difference, and said, lie with me. But he refused. And notice why he refuses down in verse 8. It says, behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater than I am in his house, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. So Joseph is pleading with Potiphar's wife and essentially saying, my master has entrusted me with this great trust, and adultery would be bad enough, but the fact that the adultery is an abuse of trust is even worse. And so Joseph is kind of showing up and doing the next right thing and leaving the results up to God again. Before we continue on with the narrative, I think there's a stumbling block here that I want to look at, address, and maybe move out of the way so we don't trip over it. And here's the stumbling block. It's Joseph's response on the face of it kind of suggests that he thinks he owes loyalty to Potiphar. And I think for a lot of us, that might seem weird because Joseph's not like Potiphar's employee. Joseph's Potiphar's slave, right? He's been stolen, and Potiphar's keeping him there against his will. Which kind of makes me think, like, does the Bible think this is okay? And I think the answer is no, and the reason I think the answer is no is actually in the next chapter, Joseph's going to describe his condition as, I've been stolen out of the land of the Hebrews. And the word stolen he uses there is the same word that gets used a little later on in Exodus 21:16, when God's promulgating the law, and it says, essentially, whoever steals a man into slavery, or whoever's caught in possession of the man in slavery, shall be put to death. So the Bible's very clear that what's happened to Joseph is not okay, and in fact, both Potiphar and Joseph's brothers are under a death sentence here. Rather, I think what's going on is that Joseph is loving his enemies, right? He's blessing those who abuse him. He's doing good to those who don't deserve it, sort of in the same way that God blesses those who don't deserve it, us. And if I were to boil it down to two principles, here's what they would be. It'd be, first, that Potiphar's sin against Joseph does not justify Joseph's sin against Potiphar. Right? Just because someone wrongs us doesn't mean it's okay to retaliate. And then the second would be that just because Joseph is being righteous towards Potiphar does not mean that Potiphar's behavior is okay. Right? That's just not how the Bible seems to address this sort of stuff. In fact, we're supposed to more or less de-link our love for other people and whether or not they deserve it, because God has de-linked his love for us with whether we deserve it. So with that said, let's maybe get back to the narrative a little. Joseph said, I'm not going to do this, and it's an abuse of trust, but notice why he thinks, why he's saying that at its root, down in verse 9. He says, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So that suggests that Joseph is thinking primarily in terms of God's honor and God's glory, not in terms of Potiphar's honor and Potiphar's glory. And I think that there's an important lesson here, which is that when we're caught up in temptation, when we're caught up in murky situations that we don't really know what to do with, we should just turn our thoughts to God's glory, and that'll enable us to see our sin clearly. So as an example of this, a few years back, me and my friend Will Fowler were sitting in his front yard with his dog, and we're just chit-chatting, and a mailman is walking down the cross street. It's not his mailman, it's the cross street's mailman. And the dog runs up and starts kind of barking at the mailman. And it's a very small dog. It's like a Cavalier King Spaniel. It's not really a threat to the mailman, but the mailman is probably annoyed with dogs barking at him. So he brushes the dog back with his big mailbag. And Will's not really happy about this, so he goes up to the mailman and says, why'd you hit my dog? And the mailman's like, why's your dog barking at me? And things sort of escalate from there. Until eventually the mailman storms off and Will comes back and he's muttering. He's really angry at the mailman. How dare he do this to my dog? And I do what I always do in those situations, which is think of the most annoying thing I could say and then say it. So I turn to Will and I say, I bet that mailman's thinking that guy's God is not very glorious. And I was saying it sort of partially as a joke and partially as a way to kind of get at the root of the situation. And what ended up happening is Will was like, that seemed to like really strike a chord in him for some reason. And so he actually goes out looking for the mailman. And 5 minutes later, he comes back, and he couldn't find the mailman. And then he sees another mailman, and he goes and apologizes to that mailman. Right? He's like, tell this other mailman I'm sorry for what I did. So there's something about thinking in terms of God's glory that cut right through the anger, cut right through the resentment, cut right through the sin, and got to the heart of the issue, which is the way he was behaving towards the mailman wasn't right. So when we're in a situation like that, I think the question we should always ask ourselves, if we need clarity or we need strength or we need kind of wisdom from God, is ask, does this glorify God? I cannot name the number of times where you ask that question and the answer becomes clear almost immediately. Does this glorify God? All right. So, stepping back to the text here for a second, Joseph is thinking about God's glory, and Potiphar's wife is not. Potiphar's wife kind of continues trying to seduce Joseph, and eventually she catches him alone, and he flees from her, as he should. And then she slanders him to the servants and eventually to Potiphar, saying that Joseph has made fun of me and embarrassed me and tried to rape me. And so notice what happens in verse 20. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. And there he was in prison. And so now it looks like Joseph's pattern has gone from upward trending graph to downward trending graph. Things seem to be getting worse. He's gone from shepherd boy in the land of the Hebrews to captive, a slave in Egypt, and now he's a prisoner in Egypt. And so I think this should raise some confusion for us because we've just finished up the narrative of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all of whom are deeply sinful people in their own ways. And they've all committed grave sin, and yet in spite of their sin, God has blessed them. And so here we see almost the opposite situation where, I'm not saying that Joseph is perfect, but his behavior that's presented at least is very righteous. And there's no clear sin that you can point to and say, Joseph sinned in this way. And yet, in spite of what seems to be his righteousness and his obedience, Joseph, his situation seems to be getting worse. He's suffering hardships and suffering. And so I think we're supposed to wonder, like, is God still with Joseph at all? Like, what's going on here? And actually, we'll see the answer very soon in the start of scene two. So let's go to scene two. And I would call scene two, God is in control in worse times. So the start of scene two is verse 21. And the narrator reassures us, essentially. He says, but the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And so if you're paying attention, that's the same basic start as scene one, except now we have a new element, which is that God's steadfast love is there and being shown to Joseph. But we have, which leads to kind of what happens next, right? We have a bad situation that Joseph makes the best of. He tries to do good work for his captors. The Lord blesses his captors through him. The captors realize what's going on. They give Joseph more and more responsibility. And eventually, Joseph is essentially running the prison, which means that he's exactly where he needs to be for what happens next. Take a look at verse 1 of chapter 40. Sometime after this, the cupbearer, the king of Egypt, and his baker committed an offense against their lord, the king of Egypt. So we have these two officials. They're caught in some kind of crime against the king of Egypt, who's Pharaoh. And Pharaoh hands them over to the captain of the guard while he sorts it out. And then the captain of the guard gives them to Joseph. So these officials kind of have silly-sounding titles, like what's the chief cupbearer, what's the chief baker, and that's true enough, but they're actually probably very important people back then, particularly the chief cupbearer. So the chief cupbearer is most likely responsible for making sure that Pharaoh doesn't get poisoned, right? So he's the guy who's trusted with making sure Pharaoh does not get assassinated. He tastes his food, probably. He tastes his drink. He handles the cup. And as a result, it would be somebody that's very trusted by Pharaoh, very close to Pharaoh, probably a confidant of Pharaoh. So this is a really powerful dude who's ended up in Joseph's care. And then they get a disturbing dream. Look at verse 6. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers, who were with him in custody in his master's house, why are your faces downcast today? So basically Joseph notices that they're downcast, or literally sad-looking, and, if I were Joseph, I would probably say, my job is to make sure that these people stay alive until Pharaoh can execute them. I'm not really going to worry about their emotional health. I'm not their psychiatrist. And yet Joseph seems to be showing care and concern for them. And in that way, Joseph is doing the next right thing and then sort of leaving the results up to God. And the answer is, well, we've both had bad dreams, so they're obviously significant, but we don't have an interpreter around to tell us what they mean. So Joseph says in reply, lucky for them, Joseph, an interpreter of dreams, look at verse 8. And Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me. So the cupbearer tells Joseph his dream. He goes first, and Joseph kind of hears the dream, and Joseph says, well, here's the interpretation. 3 days from now, you're going to get raised, your head's going to be lifted up by Pharaoh, and you'll be restored to your position. And then look what Joseph says next in verse 14. He seems to be very confident in this interpretation because he says, remember me when it is well with you, and please do me this kindness to mention me to Pharaoh, and so get me out of this house. For I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I have done nothing wrong that they should put me in the pit. And so then the baker tells Joseph his dream. He kind of sees, oh, this has gone well for the cupbearer. Maybe it'll go well for me. And so he tells Joseph his dream, and then Joseph says to the chief baker, kind of starts off the same way, your head will be lifted up right off your body, and you'll be executed in 3 days. And I'm not really sure why he phrases it that way. It seems somewhat cruel. But both events come to pass. Look at verse 20. Now on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all his servants. And he lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. And he restored the chief cupbearer to his position, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker, as Joseph had interpreted to them. So here we might think, again, at the end of scene two, that things are about to improve for Joseph, right? He's just done a very good favor for a very powerful man. He's asked the powerful man to remember him when he is restored to his position. He gets restored to his position. It's probably clear sailing from here on out for Joseph. But then we see verse 23. The cupbearer forgets all about Joseph. And in fact, we're going to see in the next verse that Joseph stays in prison for another year. 2 years. Twice as long as that. And so the question is, why does God let Joseph stay there? Why does Joseph have to stay in prison for 2 more years? He's already been in prison at this point for 11 years, or in captivity, in prison or slavery. And the obvious answer is, God has better plans for Joseph, right? If Joseph gets out now, he can't come before Pharaoh later, which means there's no salvation of Israel in the form of sending him down to Egypt to survive the famine. And that's right, that's absolutely correct. That's not a satisfying answer to me for one single reason, which is that God is the one who ultimately sends the dream to Pharaoh that causes Pharaoh to pull Joseph out of prison. So if God wanted to, he could just send the dream tomorrow, right? There's no waiting. And then Joseph would get pulled out, and so the real question is, why does God wait 2 years to send the dream that gets Pharaoh, that gets Joseph released? And my hunch here is that God is refining Joseph. He's refining Joseph through hardship. And I say that for two reasons. The first is that if you look at verse 14, it says, please do me this kindness to mention me to Pharaoh. Meaning, Joseph is still kind of placing his hope, at least a little bit, in the chief cupbearer. He thinks that these worldly powers are going to deliver him from his misfortune. He doesn't realize that his misfortune is part of God's plan. But then secondly, this is sort of the pattern of the Bible, right? Hardships seem to precede momentous events. So like Abraham has to wait several decades for Isaac to arrive. And then even after Isaac has arrived, Abraham has to offer Isaac up to God, right? Moses spends about 40 years in the Midianite wilderness before he returns to Egypt to deliver the people. And then Jesus is probably the clearest example of this. Jesus, before his work on the cross, has to go from God down to earth and live among us and then engage in an earthly ministry where, you know, he's reviled by his generation and ultimately he's mocked, tortured, and killed. And these are all events that prepare them for the great things that they're about to do. And so I think the lesson here is that God is far more concerned with our character than our comfort. God is more concerned with our character than with our comfort. And the analogy I was thinking about for this is my wife Chelsea and I, we have a Doberman. And a Doberman is a working dog. It's a protection dog by nature. And so it's got these very powerful instincts to watch and to protect and to be near us. But it's also very smart. Like, it's a very smart dog. One time, my friend watched it for a week, and he came back, and he said, I feel like that dog had me wrapped around her little paw. And so with a working dog like a Doberman, you can do one of two things. You can either treat them like a pet. And if you treat them like a pet, you feed them, you water them, you exercise them, you keep them entertained, you do all the stuff that Cesar Millan says to do. And the dog will be happy enough on a surface level, right? But there's this deep longing in the dog that's actually going unfulfilled. The dog knows, it doesn't know what it's supposed to do maybe, but it knows that there's more to life than this. And so it'll start to find that purpose in strange ways. So like my dog finds her purpose in whenever there's a loose sock anywhere in the house that has touched anyone's skin, for any amount of time, she'll steal it and she'll run off with it. And I think she's doing this because she knows that that's the way that she can get us to interact with her and pay attention to her. You know, and that's the way that she can kind of play the fun chase game and stimulate her mind. So that's one way you can deal with a working dog. The other way you can deal with a working dog is work them. And so, you know, like I was thinking about this today. Today I was playing rope with my dog, and I was like making her wait, and then, okay, take the rope. You know, and we did that for about 15 minutes. And I can take this dog for a 4-mile run in 100-degree heat because I'm a terrible dog owner, and she'll come back and she'll be fine 10 minutes later. But something about playing rope and like having to wait and having to follow commands and work made her much more peaceful. It settled her down. It settled her heart. And this analogy is going somewhere, which is that I think that, you know, forgive me for it, but I think we're all like working dogs in that respect, right? The worst thing you can do for a human is give them, is feed them, water them, keep them entertained, right? Because what's going on is that deep inside of us we have this powerful longing. We have a powerful longing to work for God, to work for God's kingdom, and we have a powerful longing for God's personal presence. And so if those longings don't get fulfilled, those longings come out in weird ways. Those longings start to come off in self-destructive ways, right? They come out drugs, alcohol, addiction to pornography, codependent relationships, you know, all forms of sin. You name it, it'll come out that way. And so, you know, God, I think God knows that because he made us that way. And so God loves us too much just to treat us like pets and take care of our material needs and not address the underlying longings. And so when I say all that as by means of encouragement, meaning when the bad stuff happens, right, and there is bad stuff, there is legitimate sadness, there's legitimate suffering, and I don't mean to deny that, but when that happens, we can know that these are afflictions that God has given us as a way of refining us and making us more like him and drawing us closer to himself, so we can take great encouragement in that. So, end of scene two. The downward trending graph has gotten much worse. Down to the right on your, from your view. And yet, Joseph just continues to trust God and do the next right thing. And we're not really sure where it's going, except in the next scene, Joseph's circumstances are going to change very dramatically. Let's have a look at the next scene here. And I'm going to call scene three, God is in control in the good times. God is in control in good times. So the narrative switches from Joseph to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh has two very disturbing dreams. The first of which is there's seven plump cows, and then they're eaten by seven very thin cows. And he wakes up, he's like, that was a weird dream. I wonder what that was all about. Oh, well, he goes back to sleep. And then he wakes up, and then he has another dream. And it's seven plump ears of corn are eaten up by seven lean ears of corn, however that works. And then Joseph, and then Pharaoh wakes up again. He's like, okay, I know there's something significant here. And he looks around, and look at verse 8. So in the morning, his spirit was troubled. And he sent and he called for all the magicians of Egypt and all of its wise men. And Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was none who could interpret them to Pharaoh. So basically, Pharaoh needs an interpreter, and none of his wise men and his magicians can do the job. And it's not really clear whether it's because they don't want to do it or because the interpretations they're offering are not satisfying to Pharaoh. But this is when the cupbearer remembers, oh, there's this Hebrew boy, and he's not a boy at this point, there's this Hebrew chap that's in prison down there, and he interpreted some dreams for me a couple years ago, and they came true. And so Pharaoh's like, well, go get him. So they bring Joseph out of prison. Joseph cleans himself up. He's going before a very important guy. And then he comes before Pharaoh. Look at verse 15. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. So this is a situation where Joseph now has a lot of leverage, right? He's standing in front of the most powerful man in Egypt. He could do a lot of things. He might bargain for his freedom. There's an idea. Yes, I will interpret your dream if you let me go. How about that? He could try to impress Pharaoh. I am indeed a very smart man, a very wise counselor. Let me interpret your dream for you. Or he could just be spiteful, right? He'd be like, I'm sorry, I have no way to help you because you are my captor and I have been here for 13 years and I do not want to help you. But instead, look what he does in verse 16. Joseph answered Pharaoh, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. So Joseph does not try to do anything cute here. He's a schemer. Joseph is not. He is not like his father Jacob, right? He just says, it's not in me. He gives glory to God. And then he says, tell me your dream, and I'll give you the interpretation. Joseph, this is, you know, just another example of Joseph trusting God and doing the next right thing and sort of leaving the results up to God. And so then Pharaoh recounts his dream to Joseph, and Joseph gives him the answer, which is, all right, well, there's going to be 7 years of really good harvest, and there's going to be 7 years of famine. And God sent you two dreams because he wanted to confirm it and let you know that the plan's not going to change. And I think Joseph could stop there, and he would have discharged his responsibility. He would have done his good deed for the day. But he actually continues. Notice what goes on down in verse 33. Now, therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land and take one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. That food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through famine. So Joseph continues, and he just gives Pharaoh very concrete advice. Get a wise man, store up some food in the good years, and then use them to keep yourselves alive in the bad years. In other words, I think this is another example of Joseph trusting God and doing the next right thing. And then, very suddenly, almost out of nowhere, Joseph's fortunes get reversed, right? Pharaoh raises Joseph up to an extremely powerful position. The text makes it clear that Joseph is essentially Pharaoh's equal. He is a co-ruler of Egypt. Only with respect to the throne is he second to Pharaoh. And then there's another little detail which is a little more obscure, but he marries Joseph to this very powerful high priestess, right? She's part of a family of high priests, probably the second or the third most powerful family of high priests in Egypt, right? So he's grafting Joseph into a powerful family, right? So essentially, Joseph has gone from the very bottom of the Egyptian socioeconomic ladder. He's not just a slave, he's also a prisoner, to the very top. There's only one person in all of Egypt that's higher than Pharaoh, and that's higher than Joseph, and that's Pharaoh. And notice why Pharaoh does this in verse 38. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you this, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. So essentially, Pharaoh has exalted Joseph for two reasons. The first is that Joseph gave him that concrete advice back in chapter 30, in fact, in verse 33. Find yourself a wise man, right? Pharaoh's only thinking in the category of, I need to find a wise man, because Joseph has said, go find one. And then secondly, I think it's back in verse 16, Joseph deflected the glory from himself and over to God. And so Pharaoh knows that this is a guy who's about God. This is a guy who's touched by God in some way. And God is with this guy. And those are basically, and that's basically the reason that Pharaoh gives for exalting Joseph. So we begin to see that all of these things that Joseph has been doing, all this misfortune, all this obedience, is beginning to weave together into this great plan of salvation for God. And we'll see the plan start to wind down here in verses 46 to 49, where Joseph executes on the plan that he's proposed. And then verses 50 to 52, where Joseph is acknowledging God and giving thanks to God for what God has done for him. And you see that in the names of his two sons. You have Manasseh, for God has made me forget all my hardships. And you have Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. And so I think we're supposed to sort of treat this as a tacit acknowledgement that Joseph understands that he's been compensated for his years of suffering, that the recompense that he's received is more than sufficient for the suffering and humiliation that he had to endure. And so I would say the application of this last scene is sort of the application of the whole text, which is that God is in complete control, and so we can do the next right thing and trust him with the results. And so we say, okay, well, now we have a full picture. What does that even mean? Like, what does it mean to do the next right thing? And I think Joseph gives us two principles that we can follow there. The first is that we should glorify God and give glory to God. Joseph deflects glory from himself, gives it to God. Joseph is focused on God's glory. If we stay focused on God's glory, we're not going to go too far off the track. And the second is that Joseph is continually caring for others in different ways. People that do not deserve it, he is caring for them. And so that's kind of what it means, I think, to just do the next right thing. And so what does it mean then to trust God with the results? Well, the heart of it is we don't need to scheme. We don't need to be like Jacob and think, how do I get mine out of this situation? I can just do the next right thing and God will take care of the rest. And then we see that Joseph gives, you know, God gives Joseph this very good result. He gives him presence of God. He gives him recompense for his affliction. And he gives him this rule over Egypt. And so we might think, I would think, okay, that's great for Joseph. I don't think I'm going to become ruler of Egypt anytime soon. Right? So where's my compensation? And I think that the answer is God's actually going to give us a better result than he gave Joseph, right? He's not going to give us his presence in prison. He's going to give us his unmediated face-to-face presence in the new heavens and the new earth. He's not just going to recompense us for our affliction. He's going to personally stoop down and wipe away every tear from your eyes. And he's not just going to make us rulers of Egypt. The Bible says that God's going to make us co-heirs of creation, right? We're going to be ruling over angels. I don't really know what that means, but I know it's important. I know it's significant. And so I think we can trust Christ when he says that there's no momentary affliction that we will experience now that will not be compensated for us 100-fold in the new heavens and the new earth. And so even if we can't see how that works right now, when the curtain drops and the play is over, we'll step back and we'll say, just are the judgments of the Lord. And so from there, the text is going to finally wind down in verse 56. So when the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Moreover, all the earth came to Joseph to Egypt to buy grain, because the famine was severe over all the earth. So God has put Joseph in this position of power, not to bless Joseph primarily, but so that Joseph can be an instrument of blessings for others. And notice which two groups of people Joseph is blessing, okay? Group number one, the Egyptians, right? He is blessing idol worshipers, idolaters, people that are opposed to God, people that are diametrically opposed to God. Group number two, his brothers. The same people that sold Joseph into slavery after mercifully deciding not to kill him and then lied to his father about it and had been continuing in that lie for about 24 years by the end of the story, those are the people that Joseph is saving. And then it'll actually go out in concentric circles from there. It'll go from Joseph's family to all of Israel, right? And then from Israel in the form of Jesus Christ to the whole world. Right, and then you'll have salvation that flows out to Jews and Gentiles and everybody. And so I think we're supposed to think of this text in terms of Jesus. And sometimes it's a stretch, I think, to get from an Old Testament text to Jesus. There is no stretching here. Jesus is clearly the better Joseph. And I say that for three reasons, okay? That first, Jesus and Joseph are both humiliated, right? But Jesus' humiliation is far worse than Joseph's. He goes from being God to man to servant to publicly beaten and mocked and then executed. And then finally, he suffers alienation from God, right? He received the due penalty of all of our errors. And then Jesus is exalted in the same way that Joseph is exalted, but he's exalted much higher. Joseph is exalted over ruler of Egypt, a temporal earthly power. Jesus is exalted to the king of the cosmos. Right now, there is a human being named Jesus Christ on the throne of the universe. And then third, Joseph and Jesus both save others through their suffering and through their obedience. Joseph saves his brothers, and he saves the idolaters. And Jesus saves his brothers and the idolaters. Which is to say that Jesus' work is so much more complete than Joseph's work that Jesus will save anyone who wants to become his brother. And all we need to do is to trust in him. Right? We don't need to do good works. We don't need to do any of this stuff. We just need to trust in Jesus. And then he'll take care of the results for us. And so I would say that this text, the story of this text, is sort of the story of the whole Bible, right? That we can show up, we can trust God to save us. That God is in complete control of our salvation. He's going to provide for us, and all we need to do is trust. Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.